The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Broadcasting for seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here's the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning Pacific Coast Time Zone Space Show program. I'm your guest, host David Livingston, and great to be back with a terrific guest who's been absent for a little while, and I'm glad we have reconnected with Mike Gold. More about that in just a minute. A couple of very quick announcements. This is a 60-minute format program, so please watch the clock. If you want to email Mike at drspace@thespaceshow.com or call him at toll-free 866-687-7223. A couple of other real quick announcements. Morgan and Lee Irons are on about their work in space, food, agriculture, and farming. They're Sunday. And then Dr. Zubrin is back with us on Tuesday, April 18th at 7 p.m. regarding his new book on the use of nuclear power. So just heads up for those two programs. Once again, toll free 866-687-7223. Don't forget that if you want to subscribe to our email newsletter, it goes out at 6 a.m. on Monday morning, again, Pacific Coast time. Make sure I have your email address. Everything we do is archived. One other thing I want to stress is that we are a nonprofit 501c3, and here is where I really stress it, listener-supported show, meaning those of you out there listening make financial contributions to us, and that keeps us on the air and allows us to do programs with people such as Mike Gold and the other guests that we've been talking to so far this year. And if you are a U.S. federal taxpayer, because we're a nonprofit 501c3, you do get a tax donation for your gift. And there's a PayPal button on the upper right side of our homepage, thespaceshow.com. That's clearly the easiest way to support us. But if you use Zelle, the email address is david@onegiantleapfoundation.org. And, of course, you can send a check to One Giant Leap. That's our parent. And that mails to our Las Vegas offices. And that address is on the PayPal button and on our website. Or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com to get that information if you don't have it. And then don't forget you can be a sponsor. You get the banner ads running across the homepage. And I shout out on the shorter formats to the sponsors, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Celestis, the National Space Society, and Dr. Ben Arroyo. And if you're interested in our sponsorship and advertising program, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. So I'm very happy that we have reconnected with Mike Gold and that he is back with us. He's the Chief Growth Officer at Redwire, and he leads Redwire's business development, marketing, and external affairs teams. He has been around for a while, and he has been on the show when he was representing many other organizations and interests. And because we're on the 60-minute format, I don't want to spend a lot of time reading about Mike, but his full bio is up on our website, and it's much more valuable to us to talk to Mike rather than to read about him. But again, do read his bio. He has a lot of vast experience, and you'll see why when Greg was on the show the other day, he spoke so highly of Mike coming on the show today. Mike, welcome back to the program after too many years of being away. How are you?
Wonderful to be back, David. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, too. Let's start off with Artemis, because you had a big part in that. So go for it. Tell us your perspective and where we stand on Artemis and what's going to happen with Artemis when things like space mining and in situ resources and other things start actually developing and coming to fruition.
It's going to be an exciting and dynamic future, David. And if I could take a step back for a moment relative to the importance and the historic nature of Artemis, you know, previously, NASA has failed to sustain all beyond low Earth orbit human spaceflight projects since Apollo. During my entire lifetime, not a single project has succeeded that when it's come to beyond LEO human spaceflight efforts at NASA, failure wasn't just an option, it's been a certainty. And that's been due largely to politics, that one administration will go to another and they'll cancel the program. And that's why Artemis was so important, because in particular, our international partners and allies were justifiably beginning to doubt that America could sustain such an initiative. And Artemis, it's the very first time, again, in my lifetime, and I'm sure for many of your listeners, that a beyond low Earth orbit human spaceflight program has gone from one administration to another. And the reasons for that, I believe, are really twofold. One, that Jim Bridenstine, my old boss, really focused on building a bipartisan coalition, that he got Democrats, Republicans. I remember when Mike Pence put out a tweet about Artemis, and then it was actually picked up and reinforced by Nancy Pelosi, and it's so rare that you would see those two in alignment. I thought Jim should have got the Nobel Peace Prize for that. But it demonstrates how space can bring us all together, not as Democrats, Republicans, but as Americans. And Jim did a tremendous job building that bipartisan coalition. And then the second part was international, that if you contrast the beyond LEO efforts that we've seen with NASA human spaceflight, with LEO human spaceflight, in particular the International Space Station, which has been the crown jewel and the foundation of human spaceflight at NASA and really globally, it has been a bedrock and it has been sustained now for decades. And part of the reason for that was the international nature, and is the international nature of the program. So that's where, you know, Jim brought me into the agency to help lead that effort and ensure that we had international support for Artemis to build the broadest, most diverse global human spaceflight coalition in history. And I'm so proud of what we did with Artemis programs, in particular manifesting in the Artemis Accords, which is the vehicle for countries to explicitly join the Artemis program, and for them to support norms of behavior in space. And kudos to the current administration, Senator Nelson and Pam Elroy, Bahavia Lal, who have kept the torch lit and have increased the number of Artemis Accords countries to 23 and have supported and sustained the Artemis program. That this has been a terrific achievement now, sustainability for America and the free world, and it will enable this brave future in space for not just the government, but for commercial entities such as Redwire and others to support all kinds of incredible and dynamic commercial activities with resource extraction and utilization and 3D printing and manufacturing, space situational awareness. It's going to be a terrific future.
And do you see Artemis continuing to expand and more countries joining it? Do you think they'll in light of the news? I guess that's what I'm really asking. In light of a lot of the news stories that we hear today on our political and international relations, are we going to be able to sustain space as countries wanting to join with America?
Absolutely. We have seen a tremendous proliferation of not just the number of countries that are creating space agencies and joining Artemis. And there's been a huge amount of those, but also the depth of that support. Now, for example, if you look at United Arab Emirates, which is still a relatively young space country, what they've accomplished has been nothing short of astounding in such a short amount of time. They've got an astronaut on a long-duration mission on the ISS currently. I believe that's the first non-International Space Station partner to have a long-duration astronaut, the HOPE mission, which was the first interplanetary probe from the Middle East, was an incredible and historic success. And we're seeing many countries in that region, the UAE, again being a spectacular example, really come forward with terrific support for space. And while, of course, it is wonderful to have our traditional space partners, such as France, was a fantastic addition, of course, to the Artemis Accords, and I'm so excited for our French colleagues to have joined. But I'm at least equally, if not a little more excited, that to see countries like Colombia, Bahrain, and in particular Nigeria and Rwanda, who recently joined the Artemis Accords. I'm so excited about sharing this incredible journey of discovery that is Artemis and the benefits and the wonder and the science of space with nations that haven't been a large part or any part of a space program before, because I believe they can benefit as much, if not more, than the existing nations from technological innovations, from the science, from the new medicines that will be produced. So I'm just so excited to see these new entrants participate and for Artemis to be the vehicle for them to join this journey of discovery that is Artemis. And again, particularly in Africa, that we previously did not have any African nations signatories to the Artemis Accords. And in December of last year, to have Nigeria and Rwanda come on board was just, I think, incredible for the Accords, for the Artemis program, and again, for enhancing that diversity and breadth of the Artemis program. And I think that momentum is just going to continue and grow over the years, particularly as the Artemis program has continued success. And it was amazing to watch the physical manifestation of Artemis come to fruition with the launch of Artemis 1, and so wonderful to see the astronauts selected for Artemis 2.
You already have an email from listener Todd, who is in San Diego, California, and he says there's been a lot said about Artemis over the years. Does it do an end run around the Outer Space Treaty, and do you believe the Outer Space Treaty has the same future as you're describing for Artemis?
Great question, and I'm a lifelong San Diego Chargers fan, even though they're not in San Diego anymore. So always nice to get a note from San Diego. I wish you could send us some of that weather.
But you're not a Padres fan, are you?
I won't root against the Padres. My old friend Gabe Sherman, who is NASA Chief of Staff, was a closet Padres fan until we got him to come out about it, and the Padres started to get hot at the same time. I'm a Red Sox fan, lifelong.
Well, that's what I remember. So San Diego for football and Boston for baseball.
Yes, I'm a native Montanan, so let's just say my allegiances were up for grabs due to the lack of
the – they have a lack of – right. Well, go back to space.
Absolutely. Well, to get back to space, the Outer Space Treaty is actually critical to the Artemis Accords and what we were trying to accomplish. The Outer Space Treaty sets forward a series of goals and objectives that I believe are common sense and are as relevant today as they were when they were adopted in the 1960s. Ideas like preventing harmful interference, free access, sharing of scientific data. These are all very important and are still very relevant. And the purpose of the Artemis Accords in many ways was to implement the objectives and the goals of the Outer Space Treaty. So the Accords implicitly and explicitly support achieving those goals. And let me give you an example of that. So one of the very important aspects of the Outer Space Treaty is that signatories agree to avoid causing harmful interference with each other. And that's great, and that's important to avoid conflict. But how do you go about achieving that? And the Artemis Accords then take it a step further with the concept of safety zones, where countries will be transparent relative to the areas in which they're operating where you could cause harmful interference. That's how you determine a safety zone. It's the zone, the area where your operation could cause harmful interference with another nation's activities. And within that zone, you're responsible for being transparent. You're responsible for coordinating with any other country or company that enters that area, and that's how we will avoid harmful interference. So the accords reinforce and implement the obligations of the Outer Space Treaty, as well as the Registration Convention, the Agreement on the Rescue of Astronauts. The accords are all about adding a degree of specificity and reinforcement to our existing international obligations, while adding a few other common sense and important values and principles, such as the free and open sharing of all scientific data, very much in the spirit of the Outer Space Treaty. Interoperability is something else that you might not see in the Outer Space Treaty, but is very important to international collaboration and creating a ecosystem in space that can be dynamic and lead to a thriving commercial society and entity. In terms of the future of the Outer Space Treaty, and the Outer Space Treaty is over 60 years old, but doesn't look a day over 30. And it still is, I think, very relevant. And because it's a treaty of principles, the Outer Space Treaty is as relevant today as it was when it's written, because those principles, there's no expiration date on avoiding conflict and peace and sharing data. So I believe that the Outer Space Treaty, by and large, has a bright future, but you can't just use the Outer Space Treaty and say, do this. We need the Artemis Accords and specificity to operationalize, to implement the Outer Space Treaty. So that's why, in regards to the question, the Accords and the Outer Space Treaty reinforce and complement each other.
Becky is in Seattle with another question, and Becky says the two big space players other than the United States are clearly not part of Artemis and probably never will be unless miracles happen. They won't be bound by any of the Artemis terms or their enforcement, for lack of a better word, of Outer Space Treaty terms. How does that factor in to going forward and doing things in space that are peaceful and commercial and productive?
So China and Russia, just to be explicit about the nations that we were referring to, are both signatories to the Outer Space Treaty. So they are obligated to support the principles of the Outer Space Treaty, which, again, the accords largely, if not entirely, reflect. So there is great common ground between really any nation that is supporting the Outer Space Treaty and the accords. Again, what the accords do is provide a more specific path to achieving those goals. And let's take a step back in regard to what the accords are in the first word in the accords, which is Artemis. The Artemis Accords are inherently linked to the Artemis program, as the name indicates. The purpose is to ensure that countries that are executing Artemis do so in a fashion that's peaceful, that's sustainable, and that supports the international obligations of the Outer Space Treaty. So if a country isn't part of Artemis, there would really be no need for them to commit to the principles of the Accords because they're not part of the Artemis program. So you wouldn't need those countries that are opponents or adversaries to the United States to sign necessarily the accords. They're not part of the program. Again, the purpose of the accords, per the name, is to show how we are going to conduct ourselves in space and commit to these peaceful, transparent processes. That being said, I think any country, even if they're not part of Artemis, committing to the principles of the Accords is a good and wonderful thing. Relative to Russia, I can't say that I take any criticism of the Accords or their lack of signing too seriously, given that their head of state is a war criminal and that we are seeing the bombings of maternity wards and the capturing of Ukrainian children, that they have, the current Russian government has so little respect for even the very foundations of civility and humanity here on Earth. I can't say that I'm taking too seriously what they would do relative to saying doing anything good in space. Relative to China, I believe that's a different situation, and that there's a great deal of common ground potentially in space policy, at least, between China and the U.S., particularly the Hague International Space Resources Governance Working Group. The name just rolls off the tongue. That was a gathering of both government and private sector participants. I was at NASA Space Technologies at the time and participated as a private sector participant. And there we developed a lot of the concepts for safety zones, and there was robust Chinese participation in that, as well as the Global Experts Group on Sustainable Lunar Activities, the GEGSLA, where again a number of Chinese private sector academics and even government officials participated. And what I observed and saw was a great deal of agreement on issues like safety zones. So, you know, you say that, you know, China will never sign the Artemis Accords, and that may be true, but I do believe that when China moves forward, my hope is that they would be explicit about how they're going to implement their obligations under the Outer Space Treaty, just like the Artemis Accords nations have. And I think that commitment will be very similar, at least that's my hope, to what we've seen in the Artemis Accords. So again, I believe there's more common ground than one might expect. So to the listener that asked the question, I have great hope for the future.
And yet, Bill Nelson and others seem to say we better get there first because we don't want their policies and laws ruling the moon or this or that or the other. So there seems to be a gap between how they view things and you and others that are on the space show view it with more hope. Any comments about that? Is that I guess what concerns me is how is their view shaping and influencing our policy as compared to your view?
I don't think the views are actually in conflict, and I completely agree and support with the comments from Senator Nelson and others that would even go a step further, that we absolutely need to be on the moon first, and that the nation and nations that arrive on the moon will be setting the rules of the road, as well as receiving other substantial national security benefits, scientific benefits, commercial benefits. Again, I can't emphasize enough that getting to the moon first and developing that lunar economy goes beyond NASA and science. I do think it's a critical national security issue, which is why I'm so grateful and so supportive of the comments and the direction that Senator Nelson, Pam Elroy, and others have taken the administration, along with the consistent and sustained support of Artemis to ensure that we get to the moon first. So I think that is very important. I also think it's absolutely vital that we not fall behind China in terms of space technology, not only in on the moon, but relative to space-based robotics, relative to quantum and utilization of quantum capabilities in space. We fall behind China at our peril And I think the war in Ukraine has taught us that the danger and threat of these autocratic nations are very real. And that, again, we ignore them to our peril, and we can never fall behind technologically. And space represents that. So I agree and strongly support the statements in the position of Senator Nelson and others. But I think at the same time, everyone would agree that there are areas for potential collaboration, space policy being one of them. A lunar sample swap might be another. Collaborating on climate change is something that NASA already does with China. So, as always, beware of false dichotomies, that it's not just an either-or issue. We do need to ensure that we maintain a lead ahead of China economically, and certainly in national security space. We need to be first. At the same time, there are areas that we can reach out productively for collaboration that will benefit both nations and the world.
Brandy is in Dallas, Texas, with a question for you. And she says, the United States, more than any other country, has what I believe a very strong advantage in getting back to the moon, and that is our private sector and the entrepreneurial companies that are working very hard to get to the moon, although not with people, but with robotics. Does our private sector add a lot to our ability to get to the moon first and to do things on the moon in the order that you're talking about, as compared to China and Russia that do not have a private sector engaged in this episode?
Absolutely. Public-private partnerships are now at the heart of not only our lunar program, but America's space capabilities in general. We are going through a second golden age of space, driven by these private sector companies. And it has made America and the American space sector the envy of the world. The innovation, the affordability, the creativity that has come from the private sector in these partnerships has been nothing short of stunning, and has resulted in the progress that we've made. The private sector is a very important part of the Artemis program. I mean, just at Redwire, we will build the solar arrays for the power and propulsion element, the gateway. Redwire will literally power the gateway. The logistics for Gateway will be carried by SpaceX. Northrop Grumman and Redwire, again, are working on aspects of the Halo. And, you know, we say that, well, it's just robotics, but actually the private sector, again, is playing a very large role in terms of human spaceflight with the human landing system on the moon that is going to be provided by the private sector. SpaceX currently has a contract, and now Dynetics, Blue Origin, and others are also pursuing the Sustainable Lunar Development, the SLD program. So the very act of bringing astronauts to the moon will be done by the private sector. And the ancillary benefit of these government programs is we've created a space sector and thousands of jobs, billions of dollars of revenue and taxes and technological innovations that have accelerated American space capability. And that phenomenon just hasn't occurred to that extent, not only in China and Russia, but even in some of our partner countries haven't seen this. So it's been just an amazing time to be a part of the commercial space sector and the space sector generally. And this just represents the best of American entrepreneurialism and diversity and what a free country can bring to the space field.
I have another email for you, but listeners, you can use the phone call line, and there's a lot of time left, so please do give us a call over and above your emails if you can do that this morning. And again, the toll-free number is 866-687-7223, which is available. And Tim sent in a note. He's in Atlanta. And Tim says, one of the big concerns is the moral, ethical, and decent behavior of our opponents, and will they carry that to and from space? But I'm worried if they have advancements in AI that we don't have, and they don't have ethical or moral constraints on how they use AI, how might that affect their positioning in space over what the United States and other countries may do that do operate with ethical constraints?
Yeah, it's a great question. Let me tackle it generally, and then we can talk a little bit about AI in particular, because this was the goal of the Artemis Accords. While we knew that there would be certain countries that would not sign and may not share our values, the purpose of the Accords, in terms of my bio, as people know, I'm a recovering attorney, and therefore I'm a big fan of precedent. Precedent is so important. And by putting forward explicitly the values of the Accords, of transparency, of peace, of open science, you create momentum, and we create a almost peer pressure internationally for countries to abide by those principles. So even if a nation doesn't necessarily share our values or hasn't signed the Accords, by showing what good looks like, by embracing these important values, you create pressure internationally that will establish international customs, and if not force other countries to abide by these principles, certainly it's an opportunity to call out any countries that refuse to abide by what are common sense, universal principles to establish a peaceful and prosperous future in space for all of us. So in terms of trying to enforce or ensure that others abide by these principles, again, that was the very purpose of the Accords. The journey is to the moon and Mars, but the destination of the Artemis Accords is peace and prosperity. Relative to AI, I can barely get my laptop to work, so I'm probably not the best to be judging what should or couldn't happen with AI, but it certainly can be frightening. And I think the caller is very justified in being concerned about what countries who lack our ethics may or may not do. And that's why establishing norms of behavior like the Artemis Accords and future efforts that may explicitly tackle AI, I think, are very important to do. And I think there's great benefits in the United States and our allied nations throughout the free world in adopting these norms of behavior, and that even if other countries don't sign, again, there's pressure globally that can be created if we craft norms of behavior to deal with AI, and we should probably be doing that sooner rather than later.
Do you know if we are doing that?
I am not tied into AI policy, I'm afraid. I don't know of any explicit AI-related activities in the space world right now, so I'm afraid I can't speak to that. However, I believe that the Accords are broad enough where if AI would be used in some fashion that would cause harmful interference, that, of course, would be a violation of the Accords. So at a broad level, it at least should deal with that. So if something is going to cause harm, whether it's AI-driven or otherwise, the Accords were established to prevent that.
I've received so far 3 emails that are generally asking the same question. So rather than to read each of the 3 to you, which would be terribly redundant, I'm going to attempt a quick little summary. And what they're basically saying is, since Redwire is commercial, which means that they want to make money in what they're doing, how do you see the economic risk, the interest rate rises, the inflation, and the problems with our economy impacting investment opportunities for commercial space down the road. Is this going to be a serious slowdown, a mild impediment, or it won't make a difference? I think that's the essence of what they're asking.
I think generally the more robust the overall economy is, the better it is for space. But conversely, space can be and has been a wonderful boon for the American economy. It's been a great bright spot. And as we discussed previously, the public-private partnerships have made the U.S. space economy the envy of the world. So I think that the dynamism and, frankly, capitalism works very well on Earth. It will work very well in space. And the creativity of private sector companies like Redwire and others are helping to manifest the dreams that we've all had for space. And I believe NASA and the Department of Defense have been very wise to leverage the innovation, the entrepreneurialism of the commercial space field. And that will result in America and the free world being safer, that we will be healthier, the world will be better, because a lot of the innovations that we create in space aren't about space. They're benefiting the Earth. And again, Redwire is a wonderful example of that. So, for example, we just recently installed the biofabrication facility on the International Space Station. We run over 600 experiments relative to micrograv biotech. In microgravity, it creates an entire new arena for commercial and scientific development. And we are constantly flying different tissues, and we'll hopefully be printing a meniscus in space this year in the not-too-distant future. And who doesn't need a good meniscus?
Yeah, I just had surgery on mine, and I'm still rehabbing from it.
Exactly. And eventually, you know, we'll be able to create whole organs in space and new cancer treatments due to creating perfect crystals in space, new types of seeds that can create crops that can grow in the desert. And while we've been talking about these benefits for a long time, we're now starting to see these innovations come to fruition, and these capabilities will only be accelerated by the introduction of the commercial LEO destinations, the commercial space stations. So I believe that we aren't even at the end of the beginning in terms of what the commercial space sector can contribute to the economy and not only benefit America and the world financially, but substantially reduce human suffering and also effectively tackle existential problems such as climate change.
Will the funding and the liquidity be available at an affordable cost to allow for all of what you're talking about, or do you think it might impede and slow things down a bit?
Well, I think if there are macroeconomic forces that increase interest rates or hurt liquidity, that will always have a chilling effect on any economic endeavor, space included. But we go through cycles, and they'll move up and they'll move down. But I think there's always money out there for real and promising and viable business cases. So while, again, the nature of the economy is cyclical, there's still going to be great opportunities, I believe, in the space sector, particularly for those opportunities that are near-term viable and will have real results.
John, who is in Fremont, California, used to be right across the bay, but now is right across the desert from me, I guess I could say. As the chief growth officer for Redwire, is this role mainly business development, dealing with mergers and acquisitions? Where are Redwire's primary growth opportunities?
Sure, great question. Business development certainly is a lot of what I do. I'm responsible for both civil and national security, commercial BD. I'm also responsible for government relations and our marketing communications, so there's quite a bit. But I can tell you that the bookings And keeping that pipeline full is what I think about when I wake up and what I think about when I go to sleep. You know, relative to our most promising opportunities, you know, certainly let me begin again with our incredible solar array products. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the rollout solar arrays, which is a terrific innovative concept. So this is a solar array that is rolled up like a carpet when it arrives in space, and then it rolls out like a carpet. So you save a lot of rocket fairing space, yet you're able to enjoy very robust capabilities, and these ROSA arrays are powering the International Space Station today. They were also used on the historic DART mission, which was humanity's first and very successful planetary defense mission. And as I mentioned previously, they'll be used for the power and propulsion element on the Gateway via our terrific partner, Maxar. I would also be remiss in saying that the International Space Station arrays were supported by Boeing. And, you know, I think many of the big primes, they take a bit of a hit that, oh, they're not innovative, et cetera. But, you know, Boeing, for example, has been a great partner that has allowed this innovative technology to flourish on the ISS in several areas. And now as we look forward to the moon, which power is going to be probably the top constraint, leveraging the rollout arrays will be really important there, particularly as we look at dust mitigation, because not only can our arrays roll out, but they can retract. So that's very important. And we'll also have a variety of important national security capabilities. So that's one of our terrific capability areas. And our cameras, and I'm doing a disservice to even call it a camera. We've got great computing potential and you know, guidance, navigation, control that you can get from our cameras. But, again, probably most familiar to your listeners, Redwire cameras took most of the pictures, if not all the pictures, that you saw from the Artemis 1 mission. So that imagery was brought to you by Redwire, and we continue to utilize those on a wide variety of systems, as well as our sun sensors and star trackers are part of any number of incredible NASA missions and private sector missions globally. The ISPACE mission, which is about to land on the surface of the moon, we're utilizing Redwire sun sensors. We've got terrific digital engineering capabilities, which, again, is so important for a wide variety of national security, civil capabilities, low-cost robotics out of our Luxembourg office. But then, as I mentioned, what we're doing relative to microgravity research development and manufacturing is simply historic. And I believe that the work that we have done, we have 9 payloads on the ISS today, and we have conducted experiments and are conducting experiments relative to a wide variety of biotech-related capabilities, as well as advanced materials that we could find new ways to create super semiconductors and new variations of computer chips, new materials for aerospace and just general manufacturing in space. And all of our payloads and work on the ISS that, again, will be bolstered and accelerated by the commercial space stations will revolutionize fields as diverse as medicine to telecommunications. So I am extraordinarily excited about what we can do in microgravity R&D and the positioning of Redwire as the only company to have successfully manufactured items on the ISS and the global leader in microgravity biotech.
Another email from Jane in Phoenix, but again, listeners, I want to put out the phone number. If you want to give us a call, 866-687-7223. Jane says, I listened carefully in your list of activities that Redwire seems to have a focus and an involvement in. I did not hear space solar power or nuclear. Does Redwire have any interest or position in either space solar power or nuclear?
So we certainly do relative to space-based solar power. As I mentioned, we have tremendous heritage and innovative capabilities in the solar array field. Additionally, space-based robotics is an arena that Redwire excels at. And again, through our expanding European footprint, what we're doing in Luxembourg, as well as our robotic capabilities in Jacksonville, whether it's space-based GRAPL or ISAM, which stands for In-Space Servicing Assembly and Manufacturing, Redwire's got incredible capabilities and will be a leader in this area. And when you combine our robotic capabilities, our ISAM systems, with our solar array heritage, that's how you get to space-based solar power. So we're very interested in space-based solar power. As a matter of fact, I believe Redwire is uniquely suited to be able to implement space-based solar power because you need both large arrays, heritage arrays, and we combine that with the in-space assembly that our robotics can assemble. That's how we bring space-based solar power from dream to fruition. Nuclear, we deal with less, although our power systems, I think, can be very relevant to that. Again, our robotics capabilities, our in-space manufacturing or in-situ manufacturing, in-situ space resource utilization that can support nuclear. So there also, I think, is great interest in that area as well. And we're going to need both solar and nuclear, but solar, I believe, in particular, in the near term, to be able to support and fuel and push forward this incredible journey of Artemis and this new era of discovery.
Susan is in Miami. I'm assuming that's Florida, but she doesn't say Florida. But she says, I'm sure it does not surprise you to know that there are lots and lots of people out there that are not supportive of private people going into space who they claim are all billionaires going for greed. And they're not supportive of lots of rocket launches because they claim the Earth is being destroyed by them and that we will, through capitalism, destroy the pristine moon, Mars, and everything we touch. So we don't have universal support for what you're talking about and what the space show supports. My question to you is, do you think that the opposition voices, which seem to be strong, especially in magazine articles and news articles, can potentially derail space movements through enhanced regulations, such as environmental regulations, which have played a factor in delaying SpaceX getting a launch license in Boca Chica?
Yeah, I think it's a very valid concern. And I think we've done a very poor job in the space industry relative to explaining the benefits of space to the country and to the world. And we need to substantially bolster the narrative that we're putting forward. And in particular, I get so frustrated with what your caller is rightfully referencing, and that I don't know if I'd say it's a majority, but certainly, like she said, in the media, you see this about the old Playboy billionaires going to space. Yet, when we talk about that, and just to go back to my own resume, so when I was with Bigelow Aerospace, we launched the Genesis 1, the Genesis 2 spacecraft, leveraging a converted Russian nuclear missile, literally swords into plowshares. We took off the warhead, put on a commercial fairing, and used it for commercial space launch. But when I talked to my Russian colleagues, they would always say that, you know, our billionaires just buy yachts. Yours create space companies. And I think that we are very fortunate to have people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, who are taking their fortunes and plowing it into space development and enhancing our space-based capabilities that are benefiting all of humanity. And in terms of greed, I think anyone who knows those individuals and what their respective companies are about would very quickly recognize that the only reason they want capital is to be more ambitious, to do more, to go further, to create better science, and to benefit humanity more. That Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos just wanted to make money, believe me, there are easier ways to do so than the space industry. That this isn't about making money for money's sake or greed. This is about improving the life for all of humanity. And an example of this is climate change. So I would suspect that many of the people that your caller is referencing probably care about climate, as they say, oh, the rockets, you know, would hurt climate. And when I was with NASA, there was a BBC reporter that was interviewing me and said, how can you justify the expense of the space program when the world is suffering from existential threats such as climate change? And that's when I had to remind a reporter, we wouldn't even know about climate change if it wasn't for the space industry and for remote sensing and space-based satellite capabilities. And the fact that companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin, Sierra Space, are creating innovative and new ways and lowering the price and spreading the assets to space is enhancing communications throughout the world, is providing us with the information to understand how our weather systems work, how the Earth functions, and how we can combat climate change, is providing, as I described, new treatments for cancer and disease to help raise humanity's overall health and wellness and being, and to create new forms of agriculture that can feed the hungry, medicines that can heal the sick, and information that will raise the overall awareness and scientific standing of humanity. So space is a great enabler, and the entrepreneurs who are putting their money into this, I don't want to say that it's a charity or just completely altruistic, but there is a very strong element of that. And again, the reason to make money is to do more and do even better, and the entire Earth benefits from that. So, you know, I see this narrative, and it just disheartens me, because people who say that are completely missing the point. They're probably making those complaints on cell phones and telecommunication systems that wouldn't be possible without space-based capabilities. And the very issues that they care about, such as climate change, their greatest ally is the information that is being provided to them by space-based systems. And my guess is they're probably just ignorant of that. And that's as much our fault as it is theirs. So in the space industry, if I could ask your listeners and callers, go out, talk to your friends, talk to your family, talk to your member of Congress, and make sure that they understand the benefits of the space industry and the wonders that entrepreneurial space will do for America and the world.
So you've been answering that question in close to 10 minutes. So clearly it's not succinct, but it is excellent. So my experience is that when you come across these people, and I even have done CNN International, and the whole show was there coming after the billionaires in space, that first of all, they don't listen, and second, they're not really that interested. But you don't get 10 minutes of time to make your point. So have you ever thought of creating out of what you just said, which I thought was terrific, a 1 or 2 minute sound bite that can grab their attention and get the facts across? Or for that matter, any listeners listening, if you want to do that with the last 10 minutes, put it on our blog, because you don't get 10 minutes of time to make your points and to try to get someone interested in getting more information, which I guess is the goal, get them interested in getting facts.
Yeah, I've got a 10 or 20 second version of the spiel, but I know we have the time on your wonderful show, so I give the audience the full money.
So it is a big problem on communications, but the people you're talking to have to be willing to listen, and so I haven't found that many of them, they're already so fixed in their opinion that they don't want to listen. Here, you got a last-minute phone call. Good morning, caller. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for giving us a call.
Hey, David. It's John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. Go for it.
Yeah. Hi, Mike. I noticed that the mission of Redwire is accelerating humanity's expansion into space by delivering reliable, economical, and sustainable infrastructure for future generations. And that implies that, once we get space settlement started, you'll be supporting the infrastructure for that. My question is regarding, where we're going to settle space. And I know that's probably not going to be up to you, but the question I'm going to ask, as my nickname is Gravity Prescription John, is we need to determine the gravity prescription so that we know where to settle space, if we're going to be on the moon or Mars, or if we're going to be in free settlements that are generating artificial gravity. And key to that is where humans will be able to reproduce in space, to have children for permanent settlements. And there are some companies that are working on spin gravity space stations. Gravitix comes to mind, and VAST, and Orbital Assembly Corporation. I saw that you had a small centrifuge on the International Space Station, this multi-use variable gravity platform, but it's really small for looking at cellular type studies. I'm wondering if you have any plans to have a larger variable gravity facility that might be able to do rodent studies for determining the gravity prescription for human reproduction. And if not, maybe you could acquire one of these companies that are looking into the problem. I know it's a long question, but just like to get your thoughts on that.
No, but it's a good one. I appreciate the reference to our MVP, and kudos to the folks who come up with the acronyms at Redwire. Between BFF and MVP, there's just some wonderful things for our systems on the ISS. And the MVP, the reason for its size is it's, of course, to address the scientific investigations, not to create microgravity, certainly for the station. But as the biotech activities mature, I think you'll see growth in the size of MVP and a lot of our other systems as we move from experiments to manufacturing in particular. And, again, the new commercial space platforms, unlike the ISS, will be tailored for these sorts of activities and commercial endeavors, so we'll be able to utilize more space, no pun intended, and have better and increased systems. Relative to where we're going in terms of human space exploration and even robotics, obviously the South Pole is going to be first up. And we've got a number of robotic systems, again, Redwire sun sensors being utilized by iSpace. We've got a number of proposals into NASA to achieve what you read on the website about accelerating humanity's future growth in space, particularly the Tipping Point program, where we've got a lot of ideas for leveraging our robotic systems for ISRU activities on the moon. And it's that water ice on the moon. And the more we learn, the more excited we are about the vast quantities of water and frozen water that exists on the moon. And so that is going to be, I think, first up as the stepping stone in stage for humanity moving forward. And from there, Mars, and those are the two twin pillars of the Artemis program, relative to the moon and Mars. But the ability to spin that you mentioned, the ability to simulate gravity, is going to be very important for long-term health, for settlement. And I believe, particularly as we look at the journey to and from Mars and what humanity's reach is going to be like to the red planet, those are all going to be very important. And I think we can conduct a lot of that work in low Earth orbit. that we can start experimenting, learning how we can use centrifugal forces and the rotating craft to simulate gravity, to create environment for childbirth, as you mentioned, and survival of humanity generally. So I'm a big fan of what's happening with commercial LEO destinations, red wires. Part of that effort, we're really at the heart of it relative to creating the commercial payloads, the commercial capabilities to do biotech research and eventually manufacturing. And as I mentioned before, a lot of the materials research and development, because you need an economic reason to go to space. And I think we'll work out a lot of that and the technical systems in low Earth orbit and then just move forward in a bold and dynamic fashion.
John. Well, thank you. And, yeah, I appreciate the answer. And we'll see what develops. So thanks for coming on the show, and I'll let someone else call in.
Thank you very much, John.
That's a good question. And I promise you it won't be dull, John.
Thank you. Mike, I know we talked about an hour, and we're there. Is there anything you wanted to say that maybe we've missed that you want to add in right now?
No, I think we've covered a broad array of topics. I thank you for having me on the show, David, for what you're doing to get the message out and all the wonderful questions from your listeners. So I really just appreciate the time. And I'll just end by reemphasizing a topic that we covered, that please take the time, get out there, talk to your friends and colleagues, policymakers, about the benefits of space, why it's important, and how it's going to help us all. I think if we have a concerted effort from those of us in the community who care about space, who want to see humanity benefit and move forward, let's just be proactive and aggressive about talking of these benefits, so that we can educate everyone and get even more support for the incredible benefits that space is going to deliver for humanity.
Are you by chance going to be at the NSSI SDC at the end of May?
No, I'm packing my bags as we speak.
We'll look forward to talking to you again on the space show, and I thank you very much for sharing your time with us this morning. And I guess, as we like to say, keep looking up, but probably it's just beginning. There's going to be lots and lots to see going on in the future. I wish I were 20 years younger, but oh well. Thank you, Mike, and it's great talking with you again.
Thank you, David. Have a great weekend.
Okay, and listeners, that's it for today. And come back with Lee and Morgan Irons. And by the way, Lee is Morgan's father, just to clarify that. And we're talking about food and agriculture in space with their work, and there'll be some blog posts that I put up before the show. And everybody have a great, safe weekend coming up. And as always, on the Space Show, do keep looking up. Goodbye from Mike, David, and the Space Show.